This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Well, it's Tuesday, the 25th of February. I'm Alec Hogg, and this is your BizNews briefing. R.W. Johnson is our top story tonight. We had a fascinating interview earlier today. This is the Oxford Don. He spent 26 years at Oxford, a Rhodes Scholar from South Africa, a professor in political science, came back home after 1994, and man, has he been giving us unique insights into the South African political situation. This morning, he explained in some detail why our country needs to forget about higher taxes or more debt, and to grasp the nettle at last and cut state spending. This is the only viable option, Mr. Johnson says. He offers some obvious places on where to start.
But I think that the point to realize is that to make cuts, almost inevitably, given the way that the ANC runs the state as a sort of cadre deployment agency, it's very difficult for them to cut spending without damaging their own patronage networks. And that's, I think, why they are so reluctant to do it. To take an obvious example, it's still a proud boast that South Africa has a second only to the United States number of embassies and consulates around the world. Now, this is a quite ridiculous and fantastic situation. It would be no harm to anybody to close at least half of them. I mean, for a country of this size, that would be plenty. But as you know, this is really outdoor relief for superannuated ANC people. They're put out to grass in very nice ambassadorial jobs, which they don't really do very seriously, in nice places with lots of perks and so forth. And that's really what's going on. And so if you want to make a cut of e.g. half in that, then you've got a lot of very upset and angry old ANC notables on your hands. And that's not what the ANC likes to have. But you could multiply that many times over by looking through other areas of state expenditure. It's been pointed out, I think it was Tim Cohen who pointed out, there are 148 state agencies, and that many of them have got heads earning 4, 5, 6 million rand a year for not any clear gain to the public benefits at all. And again, these are simply patronage posts. And truthfully, it's high time that we should have had spending cuts on. I mean, there are lots of areas of life where I see this morning that the Institute for Economic Justice, which is, of course, pushing a wealth tax, I do hope that the DA will put its foot down and say, look, we are already far too highly taxed, and this will do absolutely nothing for growth, and this is nonsense. And anyway, the IEJ is simply another wing of the ANC, basically. So why not talk to the, to the chief people in charge rather than them. But I noticed that they said that spending cuts will invariably hit the poor. Well, this is nonsense, of course. The spending cuts, which I've just been talking about, wouldn't affect the poor at all. In fact, they would be rather good for a lot of poor people because you could make corresponding changes elsewhere for their benefit. So, I mean, I don't think one should listen to that sort of nonsense.
Isn't it so irritating when you get these politicians who are giving self-serving statements like, oh, those spending cuts are cutting our agencies, or ambassadorials around the world are going to hurt the poor. Ah. Anyway, it is what it is. And the wealth tax, from what I understand, within the cabinet is an absolute definite non-starter. Scare tactics from the ANC, and as R.W. Johnson says, another branch of that organization. Well, on a similar theme, another interview that I conducted this morning, which is going to be of great interest to the BizNews community, and is up on BizNews TV right now, was with Rob Herzhoff, capitalist activist. We chat every Tuesday. We've got lots to talk about. And today we picked up on this theme of cutting state spending. And Rob says, well, you should be applying business logic to the dilemma. And that is the only way to have a look at it. So imagine government like a failing business.
They've got to cut costs. They've got to fire 200,000 civil servants. The bloated bureaucracy of this country, the money-draining state-owned enterprises need to be privatized. It's very, very obvious. And this morning I was chatting to my wife and she was going, you know, this is ludicrous. I mean, it's absolutely ludicrous talking about wealth taxes and VAT hikes. They don't work. At this point, you're just going to have taxpayers further exiting the country. What does work? Well, if you understand business, which nobody in the government seems to do, they've never made money other than maybe Gate and McKenzie and one or two of the DA people. If you understand business and you have a company that is collapsing, a company that is actually about to fall apart with too much debt, way too much cost, and lack of profits, no growth, either the company goes bust and ceases to exist, or a turnaround specialist, and there are these people, come in, buy the company at 10 cents on the dollar, and turn it around in short order. And when I say in short order, they do things immediately. The minute they have bought the equity, they go to the debt holders and they say, your debt is worthless. I'm not paying you interest. I will pay your money back, maybe, if I can turn this company around. And you're going to forego interest for a period, 2, 3, 4 years, at which point you'll get your money back if I can get my work done. And he or she gets the deal signed with the debt holders. So debt ceases to be a problem for the time being. The turnaround person is given the time to fix the company. And that happens on day one. The equity holders basically got 10 cents on the dollar. They're gone. And this person owns the company. What's the first thing they do? First thing they do is fire most of the management. They just get rid of them. They fire the second level of management and they sell off or close down as quickly as possible the divisions of that company that either aren't making money or never will make money. And this happens in the first few days. It's like a knife, or as Javier Milei would have, a chainsaw. And that is what happens immediately. Cut costs to the bone. Get rid of debt for the time being. Say bye-bye to the equity holders. Fire management, sell divisions. And that is the only way you can catch this falling knife. Now, South Africa is in the same position. It's a failed state. It's a company that's about to go bankrupt, always bankrupt already. And you can't borrow money. They're not going to lend this country any more money. If they do, the IMF will come in, which actually be a good thing because the IMF will force upon South Africa these turnaround issues that I'm saying are essential. And the bloated bureaucracy in South Africa, these civil servants that are doing nothing and being paid a fortune, we need to fire them. 200,000, gone. We need to take our 32 ministries. And I keep saying, what a joke. This is how pathetic Cyril is. 32 ministries. Merge some, get rid of some, shrink it down to, let's be generous and say, 16 ministries, half the number of ministries. You get rid of a massive number of useless civil servants that are asking for the budget, spending money they don't need to spend, wasting taxpayer money. And you just got to fire people. We need to create economic growth. And what we desperately need at the government level is someone to say, this isn't working.
Indeed, it isn't. A little addendum to that. In the conversation with R.W. Johnson, he explained that the International Monetary Fund, which is always the lender of last resorts for countries like South Africa, and may well be something that's been put into the back drawer and as an opportunity or as something that they might be able to use, well, it depends on getting a vote through that is requiring the support of the United States. So in other words, if South Africa does a deal with the IMF to borrow money for a bailout, which looks increasingly likely now, then unless the United States says, we're with you, that bailout will never happen. And what's happening at the moment with Donald Trump and South Africa suggests that that could be another joker in the pack that we still have to deal with. Well, on the crime situation, which is never far from any heart in South Africa, Ian Cameron, the chairman of the Parliamentary Committee on Police, has been doing a wonderful job. He spoke to Chris Steyn about the efforts that are being conducted to turn things around at the SAPS. There's a long way to go, but there's some quite significant progress. Let's listen in.
So what are the most urgent interventions you would like to see implemented now?
Yeah, so I think there are a few interventions, and I'll start from a national level first. We've spoken about the skills audit that needs to be done in the South African Police Service, and it has become a resolution of Parliament, which is positive. It's the first time ever that this has been done, especially with regard to the South African Police Service. And so I'm grateful for that. The question is, when will it happen? So I saw the letter that the Speaker wrote to the Police Minister. The Speaker of Parliament said that, you know, it had to be implemented within X amount of time, and we're waiting for the feedback on that. Two questions around it is that it mustn't be done by the police's own internal audit. I mean, you can't have the regulator being the regulator can't be the regulated. And I think that's one of the bigger worries. In terms of what follows the skills audit really comes down to integrity testing. I think integrity testing in South African Police Service is not nearly up to scratch. We've seen the pushback that the Minister of Police has been receiving internally after questioning certain things and you know, figuratively speaking, poking the bear, you know, and asking questions that make people very uncomfortable. And I think that integrity testing not only needs to be done by the relevant people in the broader law enforcement authorities, but even that can be audited from external entities. You know, I've even started playing with the idea of asking the SIU to potentially go and look at integrity testing. How can they audit the top 50 in the South African Police Service? Or we take all divisional commissioners, national commissioner, the deputy national commissioners and all the provincial commissioners and do a skills audit, but along with that, an integrity testing process with them and determine who should stay, who shouldn't. And it'll also point us in a certain direction as to who to investigate and who needs to go. And I think when we clean up management, and I know people say, but, you know, we've been talking about this, but it's important, and this leads me to the next point. When you look at a division like crime intelligence, it is carnage and chaos, you know. And to me, it's become a fight, not just between potentially good and potentially or allegedly evil, but in some cases, it's literally just faction against faction. And it's become a very dirty political fight as well. You know, you see messages doing the rounds where certain senior people, sometimes I believe it really is them writing the message, and other times it's alleged that it was them writing it and it could be someone else. But where these messages do the rounds where they tarnish each other's names. And it's made it very difficult from an oversight point of view. Because you can't tarnish the entire or discredit the entire establishment, because everything is not bad in the establishment. And it feels very odd for me to say, because I'm one of the first people to call certain wrongs out. But I can tell you that there are good people in the South African Police Service. So this fight in the crime intelligence environment is to the detriment of people in the country, of ordinary South Africans.
In the world of business banking, the bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Out of the ordinary.
At Sun Exchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
Well, thanks, Ian Cameron, for that uplifting insight. On to the G20 meetings, or the boycott from the United States has taken the shine, a lot of the shine off it, but they continue. And today, central bankers and finance ministers met in Cape Town. Bloomberg, our partners, caught up with the South African Reserve Bank Governor, Lesetse Ganyago.
The decisions of the Fed are decisions of a major economy. We are a small open economy. Those decisions will affect the global economy and how they feed into our own decision-making process is through two channels. The first channel is the trade channel, right, which in normal circumstances, it would just be that a slowdown in economic growth in the U.S. leads to a deadline in our own exports. By contrast, when the economy is doing well, our exports to the U.S. Would also do well. Enter tariffs. Once tariffs enter that space, to the extent that the U.S. disinflationary process would slow down or even reverse, it might force policymakers there to reassess their position. Which way they assess it, right, is another matter. The point here is that we would then be affected by a rise in global inflation, and the extent that that recalibration of policy leads, right, to tightening of global financial conditions, capital flows, and a repricing of South Africa.
Do you think that
assets
will affect then foreign direct investment into South Africa if we do see it play out the way you just outlined there?
Foreign direct investment does not so much respond to monetary policy actions, but the trade policy actions would could actually affect foreign direct investment. How? At the moment, as a small open economy, what we do is we attract foreign direct investment,
right,
that produces goods that we sell to other countries. So we have got American companies that have established shop in South Africa that are producing to export into the African continent, and some of them back into the United States. And right, if that is to affect them, then it would affect our FDI.
Really quick, Governor, it sounds like you're saying tariffs are the number one risk that you're facing as a central bank governor in setting policy. Is that fair to say?
Well, tariffs are a risk to the global economy and to the global disinflation process. And what I'm saying is that a year ago, it was not something that we were worried about because it didn't exist. Now that it is here, we have got to take that into account. And to the extent that it is clear these are the tariffs and we know that is what we live with, then we can calibrate policy to that extent. The problem is that there is an announcement of some tariffs, a suspension, a restart, a threat to increase the tariffs again, and that adds to the uncertainty.
The confusion is creating a difficult task for you.
Well, I wouldn't quite call it confusion. I would call it the uncertainty that is added, and that is a difficult one for central banks
to
deal with.
We have to.
Yeah, well, the man who is behind all of the tariffs, Donald Trump, has hosted the French president, Emmanuel Macron. And Macron, from the reports, charmed everyone in the last day or so when he visited the White House. He also appears to have had a significant impact on the way that Trump is looking at Ukraine, or in particular, the Ukraine peace deal. Here's a wrap from our partners at Bloomberg in Washington.
It seemed that Macron was making the point the U.S. still had to be involved, and Donald Trump necessarily wasn't fully on board with that, or at least didn't signal that.
Right. Well, we know Trump's position all along has been Europe needs to shoulder more of the burden for defense on the continent, as he's said in the past, including Ukraine, obviously. Today is the 3-year anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and obviously the reason for President Macron's visit. We expect that the UK Prime Minister will be here later this week to talk with Trump as well. Meanwhile, there is this minerals agreement that is still in the offing between the U.S. and Ukraine, which I think at the end of the day is mostly about shoring up U.S. support for continued support of Ukraine, or at least to keep them involved in the talks. And so I think that that was really Macron's message. And he seems to be someone that Trump listens to in the past and has certainly taken steps to ingratiate himself to the president, inviting him to the unveiling of the new Notre Dame Cathedral and things of that nature. So it'll be interesting to see what the outcome of this all will be.
We heard today from the Treasury Secretary while meeting the French president. President Trump gave us a bit of an update on the minerals deal between the U.S. and Ukraine. Here's what we said.
The deal's being worked on, and we're, I think, getting very close to getting an agreement where we get our money back over a period of time. But it also gives us something where I think it's very beneficial to their economy, to them as a country. Do you have something to say about that, Scott?
We are very close. Good. 1 yard line.
For those of us listening on Bloomberg Radio, the Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent just off to the side, on the other side of the couch from where Donald Trump was sitting, and a quick back and forth there. Is that true, 1 yard?
Yeah, I think we're, you know, 1 yard line, somewhere in there.
Didn't it's feel always like hard that when say. He was in Kyiv.
Right. I mean, you know, what we know at this point is that the Ukrainians have submitted a draft that they can live with to the U.S. And so we're now, I think, in the stage of where some of those finer details are being worked out. But some things have changed between last week and this week. And one of the things most notably is that the $500 billion agreement for access to Ukraine's critical minerals or important minerals there is no longer part of that agreement, at least in those explicit terms. There's still this idea that the U.S. Will get something for its support over the last 3 years, but it's not put in exactly those terms. Now, whether that remains in the final agreement, we have to see. But yeah, it seems like things are getting there, although what it ultimately means at the end of the day in terms of material exchange of goods or services or defense or whatnot is changing.
In a brilliant piece that he wrote for BizNews today, R.W. Johnson explains that things really have changed a lot. It's become a much harder world, and you got that from the clip that we've just watched. Donald Trump says that America needs to be repaid for all the money that it's given to Ukraine. And I suppose if you're a transactional human being, that's the way you look at things. But R.W. Johnson explains that in the Second World War, thousands upon thousands of American, Canadian, and British, and South Africans died on the beaches of Normandy and in liberating the Europe from the Nazis, from Nazi Germany, without any conception of being repaid. Of course, Joseph Stalin, who came in from the East, the Soviets, they were making damn sure that they got repaid. We have a much harder world from the ideological one that our grandparents and great-grandparents had, quite clearly. Well, we close off with Donald Trump's BFF, best friend forever, or certainly best friend at the moment, Elon Musk, who's pretty angry, it appears, about the accident that occurred in Washington recently, where 67 people were killed after a helicopter flew into a passenger jet. He has moved quickly to propose the replacement of a $2 billion contract with Verizon, which seemingly is not working, and to put in Starlink, his company's solution, which will be, well, he'll be taking the responsibility for it, but he says it will not recur this kind of horrific accident that people in Washington were witness to. Here again are our partners at Bloomberg.
Danny, another sign perhaps of Elon Musk's growing influence. What more do we know?
Yeah, Elon Musk, you know, growing his influence into the US government increasingly, and this time it involves the US Federal Aviation Administration, and that's according to a Bloomberg scoop, and arguably the FAA is one of the most scrutinized agencies of the moment. So what's happening and what we know is that SpaceX is going to implant the Starlink's terminals into the FAA to help improve and boost the critical IT infrastructure in the FAA, and that would help overall improve and help support the the national airspace system. But this does raise, as you say, a lot of questions about increasingly that conflict of interest between Musk and his business ties and the political ties that, that this entails and involves. And obviously not least for the fact that this existing contract, $2 billion worth of it with Verizon, and that remains to be seen what happens as a result of that. But this deal involves some 4,000 Starlink terminals that Musk personally had approved, and going forward, now these will be tested. So this does seem to have a long shelf life potentially in terms of this relationship. But again, this all is to improve the US airspace system, not least after the mid-air collision in DC in late January.
So what's Elon Musk had to say about the reporting?
Well, Elon Musk has, in effect, confirmed parts of it, effectively trashing Verizon, saying it's his product was not up to standard, and this is where Starlink and SpaceX comes in. And the FAA has also confirmed that they will be doing some testing with Starlink as well. And so, you know, given the scrutiny over the U.S. Airspace system, the reliability, and not least after the safety accidents and incidents in recent months and years, there has been a concerted effort, particularly under the Department of Transportation, to really push for changes and for improvements. And so this is kind of the culmination of all of those kind of pushes over the recent weeks, in fact.
Well, that's our briefing for today. It's been my pleasure to be your host. We'll be back again same time tomorrow. In other words, we'll be getting our briefing to you as soon as we can. Until then, from myself and the team, cheerio. This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to private banking service now for your business.